Ken Forrester, Executive Director at Momenta. Welcome to our Digital Thread podcast, produced by, for, and about digital industry leaders. In this series of conversations, we capture insights from the best and brightest minds in digital industry. They're executives, entrepreneurs, advisors, and other thought leaders. What they have in common is, like our team at Momenta, they are deep industry operators. We hope you find these podcasts informative. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Good day and welcome to episode 224 of Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. Today, I'm pleased to host Dominic Gallello, former CEO, Symphony AI Industrial, and a special advisor to DARPA. Dominic is a technology leader with a deep background in vertical software solutions. He has a long track record of building great products, driving an intense customer focus, and building global brands. His products have won more than 50 awards, including two R&D 100s, which are considered the Oscars of innovation, as well as a company-level Best Work Culture Timmy Award. His products have delivered several billion dollars in revenue. He was named a SaaS Top 50 CEO, an honor with an Achievement in Management Gold Award for advancing Industry 4 realization. Most recently, he has led three successful public and private software companies, resulting in over $1.3 billion in exit value, and with a 300% plus average increase in value. Earlier in his career, Dominic held executive vice president positions, leading product development at Autodesk and Macromedia, and was president of Intergraph Japan, and director Asia Pacific based in Tokyo and Beijing. He also serves as an advisor to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, where he contributes to commercialization efforts. A hands-on philanthropist, he funds and oversees the development of orphanages that have provided a nurturing home and solid education to nearly 1,000 children. An avid long-distance swimmer, he has completed many challenging races, including the Asia to Europe, Arctic Circle Crossing, Sicily to Calabria, Capri to Naples, and the Golden Gate to Bay Bridge races. Wow. He holds both BS and MBA degrees from Monmouth University. So Dominic, welcome to our Digital Thread podcast.
Thank you, Ken. A delight to be here.
A delight to have you. And I must say that you gave me a lot in terms of background bio and even some of the research I did on you, but what a phenomenal background. And I'm looking forward to an equally phenomenal conversation there. So, you know, we call this the Digital Thread podcast, and we like to think about it as one's personal digital thread, what led them to where they're at now. So what would you consider to be your digital thread?
Yeah, Ken. Well, for me, my digital thread is grabbing onto and harnessing technology shifts, right? I've experienced so many technology shifts back from mini computers to workstations to PCs and multi-threaded chips and most recently machine learning. It's been around since the 50s, but now it's really possible to use it. And of course, you know, you can't ignore large language models that is going on. In my Autodesk days, I had a reseller who once told me, Dominic, there's margin in mystery. And so when you're at the forefront of these new technologies and mystery, you can help your customers a lot.
Now, that is a notable quotable. I love that. Margin in mystery. And certainly, you've lived through quite a few waves of technology shifts that you clearly have been able to help grow. So I look at your trajectory, even in your early career. You went president roles at Intergraph and EVP at Autodesk and Macromedia. In this early time, if you had to boil this time down into three insights relative to vertical software solutions, especially for industry, what would they be?
Yeah, I would say that it's probably one important thing instead of three. If I think back at my career, I would say self-absorbing user interface that really solves customer problems better than anything that's been out there. The customers have told me over the years, they say things like, Dominic, I learned your software when I was in school and it's made my career. So it's not just a useful user interface, a useful tool, but something that customers can get passionate about. And when they get passionate about it, they tell other people. So really the focus on what I would call self-absorbing UX is very important.
Interesting. Certainly, I think the only one you're missing then on your background then would be Apple, who certainly makes a lot of claims to that. But Yeah. I guess in some sense, being that you're associated with DARPA, you had the roots of Apple's Windows user interface in there anyways at the time, right?
I'm sorry, repeat the question. I apologize.
Oh, I was just commenting on the fact that since you were with DARPA, in some sense, you were at the very genesis of what made Apple special in terms of their windowing interface.
That's right. You know, I've seen the genesis of those things and why some of those things were created, like at Xerox PARC. And a lot of it is out of necessity, right? You know, when you have four printers and only one window on your computer, smart engineers say, well, why don't I make four windows on a computer to launch four print jobs at one time?
So most recently, you led three successful public and private software companies, as you said, resulting in $1.3 billion in exit value. So Graphisoft, with which you sold to Nemetschek, MSC to Hexagon, which is a deal we know well at Momenta, and more recently, eRecruit to Bullhorn. To what do you attribute your ability to find and develop such winning companies and really help them have such great exits?
Yeah, well, as far as the finding, I think I get found. And when you build a track record, people look for the management that can do it. But again, it's focus on customer, right? If you focus on customer, then you got a few things to do. Number one is create a vision. And create a vision for what customers really want and what customers don't know they want. That's equally important, maybe more important. Look at the anthropology of what they do, and then really try to figure out how to do it better. I think the second thing is a team. Like, my whole career has been about people and putting the right skills in place and making sure you have all of the different, you know, heterogeneous skills in one team. And then the third is execution. And I focus a lot on execution. And you really have to put all three of those things together. And if you do, generally great things happen. I've built at least four next generation systems. And it's kind of interesting. Customers, they want to follow and they need to know you're building for the future, not making just the products you have today work better, but, you know, creating something for the future because they want to be led.
You know, it's interesting the way that you phrase this. You just basically execute with quality and the market in some sense finds your company, right? What I almost would have expected is that you would have talked a little bit about your negotiation or transactions expertise and such, but truly you focus on the operational execution, which I think is great. Yeah. I've always looked at it that way. If you do a good job, the market and people will find you, right? Good companies, great companies, if you will, bought, not sold, right?
Well, in fact, Ken, if you look at Graphisoft, it was a 25-year-old company, right? They had no interest in selling their company. MSC Software was over 50 years old. They had no interest in selling their company. I had no interest in selling the company. But if you build and create a fantastic brand reputation in a market, you become very attractive to inquisitive strategics.
So if there was a, I'll call it a way of productizing this or commercializing that approach you've done, certainly your most recent effort as CEO of Symphony AI Industrial would, in my mind, kind of fit that, right? For those who know Symphony AI and their overall model. So they consider themselves an innovator in industrial insight, accelerating autonomous plant operations. So tell me, what inspired you to join the company?
Well, actually, Symphony as an investment company, it's my third Symphony company. And since my first two companies, the value creation, you know, we sold for over $1 billion. So the value creation was, I don't know, 700 million. I guess my investors were pretty interested in me running the industrial company, number one. And number two, I have a manufacturing background. So it's kind of a perfect fit.
So Symphony AI Industrial describes itself as connecting tens of thousands of assets and workflows in manufacturing plants globally, and processing billions of data points daily, pushing new plateaus in operational intelligence. What would you consider to be some of your notable wins during your time there?
Well, there's so many, but I would say it's always about the future. And so if I look at, let's say, a Belgian company, actually it's a Japanese company, Nippon Gases, but they wanted to look beyond typical predictive maintenance with vibration and oil sample and those types of things. They had tons of data in their historian, quote, it was a pity that it was just sitting there and not being used. So they basically picked their critical assets and are in the process of finishing up rolling out to 18 plants. And they had great success because what happened was they started as a maintenance tool but it became a process automation tool because of basically putting the technology right next to the DCS, the control room operator, because the discoverability of leading indicators of what's going on was much better than what their DCS can provide and much faster. So it really is these customers that want to go beyond, you know, typical vibration and oil sample and infrared and use all the process data, which is a much earlier indicator. I think another company, which is just pretty astounding on the manufacturing execution, is Cargill, because they're running our software in over 400 plants. Now, there's many projects, as we know, that there's a pilot plant, and after 3 years, you've got 8 plants implemented. They've got over 400 plants. So having a scalable platform that can run across a fleet worldwide becomes very important. So, you know, I think there's just many examples, but we're blessed with those customers.
Well, blessed is right. For the audience, can you help us understand a little bit about the scope and scale of Symphony AI's industrial business?
The scope is, first of all, it's a global business. It is, I would say, focused on, there's really three areas. You know, the assets, all the machinery that's running the plants, the execution system, you know, so you're talking about materials and process and quality. And then finally, the people, right? And so the connected worker solution is really providing bite-sized work instructions to the operators, especially the deskless worker who has to run around the plant. So I would say it's very broad. It's a very global business. And obviously, it's a growing business.
So you mentioned earlier Cargill and 400 plants. That's quite an accomplishment, as we're certainly earlier, smaller stage investors at Momenta. But one of the biggest challenges we have in some of our investee companies is just simply getting beyond what they call pilot purgatory, right? Yes, you can get one or two plants, but trying to really scale that, you know, many times can be difficult. So congrats for you guys for having done that so well. I'm curious, how do you know, though, when an organization was ready to adopt your solution? And were some of the best practices that you saw in them realizing that potential value?
Okay, well, let me take it one at a time. If I think about this whole world of AI and predictive maintenance, I think three things have to be in place. Number one, they have to have had some critical failures, and they're scratching their head saying, vibration and oil, oil samples every 6 months aren't enough. I think the second thing is that they have to have someone who really wants to drive this process. And then I think the third thing is data, right? Especially in this world of machine learning. And by the way, I don't call it AI, I call it multivariate analysis, because that's really what you're doing, is taking temperature, pressure, amperage, all of those types of things, and putting in a deep learning model to try to figure out what's going on and what will go on in the future. So basically, it's the case that data becomes very important. I know you've invested in a great company in Imperial. And in fact, we found that what Imperial found out, which I tell all my customers, I will tell you that as we start this project, your data is not as good as you think. And they laugh and say, no, we've really instrumented well. Well, what happens when your data flatlines? What happens when it spikes? You know, those types of things. So we actually had to build not only an asset performance system, management system for the machine, the asset, but we had to build one for the sensors to really take that sensor data and make sense of it in case there's a gap. You don't want to have to retrain models. So we go back and impute, you know, it's almost like we do a skin graft to keep it running type of thing. So definitely in predictive maintenance, to really take the next step is a huge unknown if I'm a maintenance engineer. And so critical plant failures is kind of a good kick in the butt, so to speak, in terms of getting going. On the manufacturing execution side, that's very different, right? And by the way, there's many companies that are still running their manufacturing execution on Excel and whiteboards with stand-up meetings every morning type of thing. And there, again, as I mentioned before, you're looking at materials, you're looking at the process, and you're looking at quality steps. And I would say critical to success is pick one of those three areas, start getting that right, because you can get it right and add tremendous value to your company, and then move on from there. I had a $4 billion company tell me that we have all kinds of quality problems in terms of, but we run an Excel for the operators in terms of how they assemble, and what goes first, what goes second. It's created a lot of quality problems. It's a perfect example of start with that one task, get it right, and then expand from there.
I love it. Yeah, we're depending on enterprise software called Excel.
It's not bad.
So I see Symphony discussing accelerating autonomy for every plant in the world in terms of how they describe themselves. Now, you know, we're close to Rockwell and they've coined the term automation to autonomy, which also I think is pretty interesting. So let me ask, what does autonomy mean to you, especially relative to industrial operations?
Yeah, well, what I would say is that accelerating autonomy is a moonshot goal, right? It's kind of what, that big thing that you're never going to get there, right? I'd like to bring it a little bit more down to earth. Instead of an autonomous plant, an adaptive plant, a plant that can react much faster to operating conditions. And at the end of the day, what are you trying to do? You get more production. If I look at people like in Saudi Arabia, if I look at Modern Gold, that they had really interesting what they were doing. They were changing their set points on their control system every 21 days on their ball mill. And the ball mill is crushing the rock that produces the gold. Well, why would they, you know, 21 days seems like a long time. Why were they doing that every 21 days? Because that's when they would do their maintenance. And so they basically open up the machine, they'd look at liner wear, other operating conditions, and then change the set points on the control system. Now, with multivariate analysis and taking all of that data that's coming in, it's well-instrumented systems, we can do set point advisories for them every 30 minutes, but that's too, you don't change a line every 30 minutes. But they're, I would say, updating their set points roughly every 4 to 5 days. Now, what's the result? The result, they were already running these plants, that is crushing rock turning to gold, at 110% capacity. They got over 1% more throughput. And what that means for one mine alone is $4 million, $4 million in terms of grams of gold that they can get out of it. So again, adaptive plan much more frequently. And the amount of data, by the way, is so large that a human cannot make these decisions and make these decisions that fast. And that's what a computer can do. And that's what multivariate analysis can do.
We had a conversation recently. I'm part of the Industry 5 initiative in Europe, the EU Commission, and we were having a discussion on some of the elements of what they call human centricity. And we came up with this chart where we talked about automation and augmentation, right? So I think things like exoskeletons as an example, right? Helping workers lift. And then we also mentioned adaptive and autonomy and looked at these things in a spectrum, right? And it's interesting where you introduced adaptive pretty quickly from the autonomy perspective. I do think that there is a spectrum there. And I think we're rediscovering even the human workers in a lot of these processes. But a lot of the adaption that we're seeing is happening based from AI, right? And we've invested in a number of companies that do process automation, as you say, multivariate analysis, which I guess would have been hard to say when Symphony AI versus Symphony multivariate analysis.
Everyone
so
gets
I can understand why you didn't choose that route. It wasn't as good of a marketing one, but it's interesting to see all these converging. That's why like Cyril Perdike, who's the CTO over at Rockwell, kind of captures it all when he says automation to autonomy, right? And how all of these pieces come together. But GE used to have this, Digital had this phrase of the power of 1 in 2%. You probably remember at the beginning of GE Digital. And that still captures what I think is the biggest payback in a lot of these cases. And as you say, it results in $4 million extra gold, as an example, right? Probably for less than a 1% to 2% change in the input variables.
Ken, if I can just interject that.
Sure.
You mentioned people, and there's a lot of confusion around virtual reality to augmented reality and, you know, kind of the scale and where does it belong and those types of things. And we've always taken the position with augmented reality almost like a rear view mirror, right? You know, so you basically, your hands need to be free, your eyes need to be free, but if I need to, I can take a look at work instructions that may be not only work instructions, but also quality instructions. And what I mean by that is it's fine, like we have a very, very large multinational and basically doing the line inspections, you know, for obviously all of the health and safety type of stuff. And so not only the work instructions that telling the operator what they're supposed to do, but the audit trail of what they did, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, really an augmenting the worker and helping and assisting the worker, but you still need the worker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, the idea of augmentation is beyond simply the intellectual augmentation that we think of, or visual in the case of what you guys are doing from an AR VR perspective, but now getting more into more things like cobots is an example, right? Or how do reinforce muscle lifting capability so that you truly have the ability to have anybody work on a factory floor, regardless of their genetic muscle mass, as an example, right? So it's pretty interesting what's happening around human centricity and how much this is becoming that almost automation plus humans, right? And using each for what they do best, right? And so it's fun to see how this converges, which brings us to which must be one of the funnest things you're doing. So you're a senior commercial advisor for DARPA, again, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. For anybody who grew up in the US and really probably in the Bay Area, this is the granddaddy of all advanced research and projects. So what are some of the projects that you're advising on these days?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me say that DARPA is an amazing organization. $4 billion a year goes into investment in research, and DARPA invented the internet and GPS and autonomous vehicle and just many, many technologies. The whole drone technology really grew out of DARPA 30 years ago. It's an amazing organization. What I do and the projects that I do, I'm kind of a venture capitalist board member for DARPA because DARPA funds a lot of research. DARPA doesn't have its own R&D center. It funds universities, it funds private companies, all of those types of things. And so I help DARPA make commercial decisions on who do we want to fund, and then act as a board member to basically commercialize the projects so they don't die. Because the reality is there's some fantastic projects and then some that die, moonshot projects and some that die. So to answer your question, what I'm involved in, it's a really a wide range of things from internet security, right? So software security, AI for defense purposes, because everything we do at DARPA is to help the battlefield warrior. And then finally, a very, very large, what I would call DARPA hard project, which is a game changer. Obviously, it's a top secret project, which is a game changer for our national defense. So, you know, the government can fund things that private companies just can't afford to fund. And it's a delight to be involved in those things to make sure that they actually work and they survive and they get commercialized.
Well, and being headquartered, as in you're headquartered in Silicon Valley, it's actually pretty interesting because you have the best of large institutional government, if you will, style defense, you know, research. And then, of course, the ecosystem that is venture capital and the startups in the Bay Area. So you get the best of both, and groups like NQTEL who kind of sometimes sit at the middle of there, right?
That's right.
In terms of helping funding with them. Or what's the other one? Defense Research and Logistics Agencies? Out of Moffett Field. I remember the one there.
Right.
Yeah, so they basically also operate as a bit of a middle ground between the military and some of the startups that are out there. So pretty interesting space to be in. So I know that you've recently left Symphony AI Industrial. So I'm curious, and I'm sure our audience is wondering, what's next for you?
Well, first and foremost, I've got some pretty challenging long-distance swim races that I have to stay ahead of the sharks. What I'm doing with DARPA is just fantastic, and it's likely that I will run another company. So I'm always doing a lot of different things, but I'm really enjoying what I'm doing for the government with DARPA.
A good time to be at it as well, with a lot of the reshoring work going on, and sadly, with some of the conflicts that are going on around the globe, very timely. Yeah. You know, it's funny, 10 years ago, I used to work at Lockheed out there. So I remember, you know, way back the military-industrial complex, right? And then it was certainly viewed as a hot space to be in. And then, of course, we went through this where there was never going to be any more war, so we don't need a lot of defense, i.e. speaking from a, you know, kind of Western global perspective, right? And all of a sudden now, what is it? Defense stocks are the ones that are really bringing the most return and value these days, both in Europe and in North America. So I guess it's best never to rule out the need for such things in the end, as Israel certainly has found out. So in closing, where do you find your personal inspiration?
Well, for me, I'm a voracious reader, so I read a lot of books. And so recently, you know, as I started with DARPA, I read The Pentagon's Brain, which is Andy Jacobson's book. And she also wrote Area 51. I read both of those books. And by the way, during the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, our government employees and those massive projects they were working 7x24. The most selfless people in the world weren't the private industry. I mean, in fact, the government was the private industry in those days. And I actually just finished up Walter Isaacson's book on Da Vinci. And there's a lot of inspiration when you watch a guy like Da Vinci, who went from basically building stage props, and that was a lot of his flying machine stuff in the early days, to what he did. So books always inspire me, and I've always got one on the plane, and I'm always reading.
Excellent. Some good recommendations there. And I certainly have to put them on my hopefully soon to come summer reading list as I'm sitting here in the snow of Switzerland. So
they're all pretty
already
thick
thinking
books.
About the beach, baby.
Be careful. They're pretty thick books.
Yeah. So, Dominic, I thank you for sharing this time and insights with us today. It's been a really great conversation.
Ken, it was a delight. Thank you.
As well. I really appreciate you taking the time. So this has been Dominic Galello, former CEO of Symphony AI Industrial and advisor to DARPA. Thank you for listening, and please join us for the next episode of our Digital Thread podcast series. We wish you a momentous day.
You've been listening to the Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please check our website at momenta.one for archived versions of podcasts, as well as resources to help with your digital industry journey. Thank you for listening. We'll